Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
For our first hour, three views on politics around the world. We'll hear about the political scandal in South Korea and Russia's growing global influence. But first, a look at the failed referendum in Italy. On Sunday, voters rejected a referendum to reduce the power of the Italian Senate and cede some regional power to the central government. Reformers said that cutting the number of senators from 315 to 100 would streamline governmental decision-making and save the public $530 million a year. But opponents of the idea feared putting too much power in the hands of the prime minister and away from regional officials. Of the 33 million citizens who voted, roughly 20 million rejected the measure. Centre-left Prime Minister Matteo Renzi said he will resign after losing the referendum. Joining me now to talk about the vote and the future of Italy is NPR's senior Europe correspondent Silvia Poggioli. She's joining me from Rome today. Good morning, Silvia. Hello, Silvia?
Yes.
Ah, good morning.
Good morning.
We're wondering, what were voters really rejecting here? Was it a rejection of changing the current political system or a rejection of Prime Minister Renzi?
Oh, it was, first of all, definitely a rejection of Prime Minister Renzi. It was very personal. It came up, in a way, it was his own fault. When he first proposed this referendum, he was riding many months ago. He was riding very high in the polls, and he said, "If the reforms, if the amendments are rejected, I will resign." And he admitted at one point during the summer that it really had backfired because the polls were already very much indicating that he would lose. And the opposition parties, it was a great gift for them. They just all very different among themselves. They rallied together essentially to wage a very personal campaign against Renzi, and he lost. He lost very much, even much worse than he would have expected.
Now, he was in power for, what, 2.5 years or so, and his popularity really did decline so steadily. But when he came in, he billed himself as kind of a demolition man, the anti-establishment candidate. But then the coalition that campaigned against him successfully was also anti-establishment. I mean, what was it?
Exactly that. You're right. He came in very much as an anti-establishment man. His critics say power went to his head. He became a little too cocky, and he became then identified with the establishment. Actually, in a way, also, you know, he tried very hard. He did pass a lot of reforms, far more than any previous government had done. But the economic situation is very bleak. He has not succeeded in bringing that up. He ignored the situation in particular of the South, which is in worse economic shape, and of youth. Italy has, the way also Greece and Spain have, a very, very high youth unemployment. It's close to 40% here. And essentially, the young people, more than anybody else, turned against Renzi. They voted 70%. The overall rejection was 60-40% nationwide. Among young people below 35 years of age, 70% voted against the reforms. What's happened also, and I think this is probably happening in a lot of parts of many other Western countries, there's a great impatience. The vagaries of public opinion change very rapidly, and the tide turns very. It's very hard for somebody now in power to get things done, to deliver results in such a short time. People are more and more impatient, and politicians are paying the price.
Of course, this comes at a time where we've had several electoral upsets, referendum upsets in the presidential race here in the U.S., Brexit. In a way, was the electorate primed to make big change?
Well, I don't think that in any way you could say that the Italian electorate was emulating the British in the Brexit vote, or It was not an anti-European Union vote. It was, in a sense, though, in many ways, the grim economic outlook is blamed a lot on the condition of the Eurozone. Many southern European countries have paid a lot. The crisis has been particularly high for these less economically productive countries in the south. And so there is a lot of blame on Brussels for the currency. And with the migration crisis in Italy, there's a sense that Italy's European partners have certainly not helped out. They've made it much more difficult. They haven't paid their share. They haven't held their share of the burden of the migration crisis. In that sense, there's a resentment against the EU, but nothing really quite as isolationist, let's say, as half of the 50% plus of those who voted for Brexit in the UK.
We're talking this morning with NPR's senior Europe correspondent, Silvia Poggioli. Now, let's maybe look at the next steps here in Italy. I mean, what is the likelihood that President Sergio Mattarella will call for an early election instead of appointing a new temporary prime minister?
Well, actually, he can't, and all indications are that he doesn't want to, because there's, again, nothing is very simple in this country. But there's an election law that was passed about a year ago with the idea that it would go into effect if these constitutional amendments were approved, because it's basically only for the lower chamber. The amendments would have more or less eliminated a direct election to the Senate, and the Senate chamber was going to be really reduced in its powers. Now we have this totally anomalous. There's a new law for the lower chamber, and there's a completely different law of proportional representation for the Senate. And the new law is also before the Constitutional Court, because it's not clear whether it's constitutional. And the court ruled, said yesterday that they will rule only on January 24th. That means that elections, if the law is approved and it's okay, still a new law would have to be redrafted to make it in line with that of the Senate. So there's no way there could possibly be elections here, I think, before April or May at the earliest. And I think so Mattarella will probably, Prime Minister Renzi is going to hand in his resignation formally. It's been announced within the next 2 or 3 hours. Today, Mattarella will do consultations and probably ask Renzi just to stay on for a few weeks until he finds a way of cobbling together a caretaker government. It's having elections within the next few weeks, 2 months, is all completely ruled out, even though that's what all the parties want.
So, I mean, this is really confusing to us here, obviously, from afar. I mean, what is the sense of the people in the street in Italy? How are people feeling about what's happened?
Well, as I say, if you talk to somebody who voted for the no, they feel that they've been vindicated. They're very happy. Those who voted yes feel that this is, once again, Italy lost a chance to sort of modernize itself. There's no question that having had such a broad rejection, there's no likelihood there's anybody, any future government for maybe a decade or two could ever try to now reform the parliamentary system. This Italian system of both the two chambers that basically have exactly the same duties makes it, the legislative process, extremely lengthy. It's one of the reasons why nothing gets done. It also encourages corruption. Lobbyism a lot, and these changes certainly the government, Renzi said, they would have put Italy much more along the closer to the European norm of one main chamber in the legislative process. But those who oppose, you know, this is a conservative country. The Italians don't like change. It's whether they're on the left or the right, they're all quite conservative in terms of modernization, and so you don't feel that much anger because so many people were against these amendments.
Now, I mean, one of the groups that was showing a lot of anger was the Five Star Movement, which some people consider one of the party that's a big winner in the referendum. Beppo Grillo is the founder of the Five Star Movement, a comedian and a somewhat polarizing personality. some people also see him as perhaps a future prime minister. I mean, what could he end up in that role, and what kind of a prime minister would he make?
Well, that's the big question. You know, a few months ago, a lot of people in the United States are saying unlikely that Donald Trump would ever be elected. But, you know, so nobody's going to hold it. Of course, the idea of a five-star, well, first of all, Grillo, because of a certain situation, he personally could never become the government leader because he was involved in an accident some years ago. He was accused of manslaughter. Therefore, under Italian law, he cannot run for parliament. He cannot hold any office. But he is, of course, the strong man, the leader behind the party. The party terrifies certainly Italy's European partners because it, again, it's not necessarily anti-European Union. It's not like the Northern League or like Marine Le Pen's National Front or like the UKIP in Britain against the European Union. But he wants to hold a referendum for Italy's membership in the Eurozone. And that also sends a lot of fears among European leaders because that could, you know, unravel the entire single currency system. What's interesting about the movement is that it cannot be specifically labeled left or right because the party has been able to get votes from the left to the right. But it is not really in the mainstream of the leftist movements because on certain issues it doesn't talk very much. The party doesn't talk very much about immigration, but they're definitely on the anti-immigration front. And their whole economic policies are all rather strange. And so it's not a mainstream party, and the idea that they would, I think probably all the other parties could get together to try to cobble together an election law that would prevent or would at least not help the five-star movement come to power.
We're talking with Silvia Poggioli from NPR, who joins us today from Rome. Well, we should talk a little about the larger European scene because, I mean, all this is obviously making the EU nervous, probably. The Financial Times, a paper that's not known for its hyperbole, predicted that a rejection of the referendum would bring about the end of Europe. What does this really mean for other countries in the European Union?
Well, I think that you're right. That was an exaggeration in terms of the Financial Times. The fear was that if the referendum doesn't pass, could then this sort of populist wave, could this lead to the five-star movement getting into government? That's what essentially is the fear. It's too early to say that that has happened. Therefore, I think it's too early to say that the results of the Italian referendum are a devastating blow to European unity. What it is, though, it's an added element of instability in an area that is already looking with great concern at 2017, where there are already going to be elections in Netherlands, in France, and in Germany, and now possibly in Italy at some point next year, all countries where these populist anti-establishment movements are really gaining ground. So the Italian situation is just an added element. It's not going to be the trigger of the that's going to just totally unravel European Union and bring down the whole Eurozone. But it's just one more element of instability. Had Renzi prevailed, Brussels would have said, okay, Italy is calm now. We don't have to worry about that. Now they also have to worry about Italy.
Of course, I mean, we're talking about things being confusing. I mean, it's confusing all over the place. I mean, there is the Brexit situation, which seems to just get more confused with every passing week, depending on who has said what and what court has ruled what. We also have François Hollande in France, president, has said he won't seek re-election. And Angela Merkel apparently may be facing problems for her re-election in 2017. There was actually a headline in today's Star Tribune here in the Twin Cities saying that Merkel is the last Obama ally still standing in Europe. But there was one big upset for the populist movement in Austria, where the leftist Alexander Van der Bellen defeated Norbert Hofer. What what did that mean, and what does that say for the future of Europe?
Well, again, that's one less area to worry about, because there was a lot of concern should Hofer win. He would have been the first really hard right head of state elected freely in Europe since World War II, which was also, you know, a rather chilling prospect. And also because he had indicated, suggested that perhaps Austria, that he would like to see Austria leave the European Union. So, again, that's one less element to worry about. Austria's okay now. And it is also, it is, the position is a more formal, more symbolic. It isn't, it wasn't, the presidential role is not so, so terribly central in the government of the of Austria. So that's just one less problem, as I said. But, you know, I think now everybody's looking with, the biggest concern, of course, is going to be France, where Marine Le Pen and the National Front are, you know, considered, you know, doing very well. And also there's a situation in the Netherlands where a conservative party led by Geert Wilders, who is very, very Islamophobic, xenophobic, he's doing very well in the polls. So these are all countries that, you know, had always been dependable, Western NATO allies and so forth, where there's this growing unease, anti-establishment movement growing a lot. So everybody's very nervous about what will be happening in France, the Netherlands. I think Merkel is weakened, but we still, you know, she is also has a growing populist right-wing movement in Germany, but I think she's still fairly, I think she can, she's fairly in good condition, at least right, looking at it right now. The elections will be next September. We don't know what could happen between now and then.
Just briefly, I mean, you have been covering Europe for a few years now. Have you ever seen a situation like this with this populist wave catching on like this?
No, not at all. Never seen anything quite like this. I covered also a lot the fall of communism in Eastern Europe. And in some cases, in the wake of that, there was a lot of sort of, there were movements that were sort of, the right was very much also revived in some of those countries. We see certainly worrisome trend there now in Hungary and also in Poland. But what's happening across Western Europe now, frankly, I was as stupefied as everybody else was that Brexit passed. It was, seemed to me, impossible. But, you know, we're in for, we've been in for a lot of surprises this year and a lot of elections. Perhaps the one in Italy was the least surprising. It was just the extent of the rejection that was surprising. But I think we have to prepare ourselves for a lot of instability in the months ahead.
Silvia Pagioli is a senior Europe correspondent for NPR. Thank you very much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
And now on to South Korea, where President Park Geun-hye has been sinking into deeper political peril following the revelation that she used her position to secure millions of dollars in donations to her foundations. Her close friend and confidant, Choi Soon-sil, is facing abuse of power, fraud, and coercion charges. Plus, two of Park's former aides are also looking at criminal charges. I asked the BBC's Steve Evans in Seoul if he thinks President Park will just step down in the wake of the controversy.
It's not likely at all that she's going to step down before the impeachment vote. She's playing a very clever political hand here. She says that she will go if Parliament can agree on a timing. But she's also said that if Parliament goes ahead with the vote on Friday, she's going to stay there as long as she can, and it will be months. So it is going to be a long, drawn-out process. But it seems pretty sure that she won't last out her full term, which is until the end of next year. Her ratings in the polls are pretty well at rock bottom. 5%, then you think it can't get any lower. And then it goes down to 4. Now it's come up a bit now, but it's still very low. And every single Saturday in this city, we have hundreds of thousands of people demonstrating. They walk to within 300 feet of the Blue House, as the presidential palace is called, and chant that she should go, hundreds of thousands, and that's not going to go away. So her problems will continue, and her problems are, the central problem is that she had, because she's severed links now, a very close friend outside politics for 40 years, and this friend controlled two funds. And it seems, it's alleged, that this friend went to very big companies, Samsung and all the big companies in South Korea, and said to them, I'm a friend of the president's, you need to give substantial sums of money to these funds. And the big question is, how much did President Park know about that? Prosecutors think she knew a lot, but they can't prosecute her while she's in the president's job.
And that is because she has immunity.
That's right. She has legal immunity. But the moment she loses that job, either because her term is over or because she's kicked out by Parliament, by the Assembly, then she's open to prosecution. And it looks very likely that she would be prosecuted. Pretty well every president of South Korea since democracy started here, and that's only 30 years ago, remember, has got embroiled in corruption. And that's because the big companies here and the president are very, very close. It's the way it's always been. And the president thinks that he, until President Park now, can kind of direct the companies and say, well, you know, this is in the national interest, you need to do this. And in the past, that kind of close relationship means that people around the president think that they can put pressure on companies and leverage a bit of cash out of them. And when I say leverage a bit of cash, I mean a lot of cash.
Well, just put this into context for us. I mean, you said that the President Park's approval rating is in the single digits, 5%, 4%. I mean, how does that relate to previous South Korean leaders? I mean, is this as bad as it's ever been?
It is as bad as it's ever been. There was a time when South Korea was technically bankrupt in the Asian financial crisis. Even then, with the country bankrupt, the president's ratings weren't as low as this. So it's very, very hard to find anybody in this country who is in favor of President Park. I mean, I did go to a demonstration the other day of people in favor of President Park, and interestingly, the election of Donald Trump. And, you know, they were very vociferous for Park and Trump together, and bracketing the two together. There must have been 40 people there. Well, you contrast that. I mean, there are absolutely vast demonstrations every Saturday, and they're very peaceful. Lots of kids in pushchairs and buggies and people holding candles. No hint of violence. You know, vast numbers of people, and these aren't the usual suspects. These aren't the kind of usual protesters who make almost a profession of it.
We've been seeing a lot of TV coverage of the demonstrations, and apparently last weekend organizers claimed that there was at least 1.7 million participants, although the police said the crowd was actually more like 300,000. What is it that those people are most angry about? Is it the corruption? Is it about lack of leadership?
I think it's, well, there's this global thing going on at the moment, you know, and you know about it in your own country, where there's a lot of anger out there, and there's been an awful lot of effort, you know, expended by journalists and academics trying to understand the cause of this anger, and it's a whole heap of factors. You know, it's a kind of a vague cloud of anger at the establishment. So there's all that going on. There is anger at corruption at the very top. This is a very odd society in that the amount of honesty on the ground amongst ordinary people is extraordinary if you've come from outside. You know, you can just leave your bike. People leave their pocketbooks here on bars to reserve a place at that bar, and then they go away and come back, and their pocketbook, their full pocketbooks, will still be there. That's how honest this place is. But at the top, there is this corruption. You know, the heads of the big conglomerates, the chaebols, the family-owned conglomerates, have very often been imprisoned for corruption. So there is this corruption at the top, which people are angry about. But on top of that, if you talk to farmers, for example, they're angry because rice prices are at rock bottom. The government is trying to take control of history books here because it wants a more nationalistic, it would say patriotic view of history in schools, compelled to be taught in schools. So there's a whole heap of issues which are making people angry in this amazing global phenomenon.
We are talking with the BBC Steve Evans, who is calling us from Seoul, South Korea, about the scandal that is rocking that country and perhaps may result in the president having to step down. Now, I'd like to ask you about this extraordinary hearing which happened earlier this week, where the heads of nine of the country's top conglomerates, which control nearly half of South Korea's economy, faced a grilling, an unprecedented grilling by lawmakers about this situation, about the donations which they had given. Tell me about what a spectacle that must have been.
Well, it was a spectacle, and it was a spectacle because these people don't appear in public. They shun publicity. They are immensely wealthy. You know, on my back of the envelope calculation, the poorest among them was worth $330 million, and that goes up to the man in control of Samsung at the moment, who's worth something like $8 billion. So they're immensely wealthy, and they live in that kind of bubble of power and wealth. They get driven around in, you know, the standard black limo with the darkened windows. You know, you never see them in the cars. They do not do interviews. They never, ever do interviews. And yet, there they were in the National Assembly. They filed in. They sat in a line. They stood. They raised their right hand and said they'd tell the truth. And they were given a hard time. And in this sort of bizarre spectacle, press photographers remained. And so you had that kind of constant barrage of clicking throughout the whole thing as they were questioned, with these photographers up on their ladders, craning over at these very powerful people. And they were questioned, they were given tough questions, which, I don't know, maybe they thought they were impertinent, maybe not, but certainly they were there and they answered them. And the gist of the answers was, well, we did give money, but we do give money to what we are told are good causes. That's what good corporations do. They denied that there was any influence, that there was any quid pro quo, because the allegation is that when Samsung gave money, for example, I think $17 million to these funds, that the quid pro quo was they would get approval for a merger that was going through. Another big retail company was, the allegation is that it gave its money and was then given permission to set up new duty-free stores. They denied that there was any kind of payback for the money they gave.
As you mentioned, these were extraordinarily well-off and powerful people. I mean, is there any evidence that they needed to curry favor with President Park? Or is this, again, a kind of a populist myth?
I don't think it is a populist myth, because if you look at, I mean, some of the men on that, in that row, you know, these immensely powerful, immensely rich men, have been to jail. You know, the history of corruption at the top of chaebols is there. They've been to jail, and they often then get pardoned by the president. So it's not, you know, the mainstream media, you know, sort of weird left-wingers making up stories about corruption at the top. It's there. It's been through the courts. There is a kind of a culture, and people will say, and lots of people will say, the culture needs to change. These are immensely successful companies. Samsung is a very successful company. It's giving Apple a run for its money. But the argument is that they've grown up in a culture where government and big companies are too close to each other. The current President Park's father was a military man who seized power and who then became a civilian, but remain very authoritarian. He created this economy, or he laid the foundations for this economy, basically by telling big businessmen, you need to invest in a shipbuilding industry or a car industry. There was that kind of relationship where the president told the companies what he expected them to do for the good of the country. And they, in turn, expected a good reward for that. So that's a very cozy relationship, which might have worked pre-democracy when you're trying to build a country and an economy from the dirt, literally from the dirt, and not only the dirt, but from the blood of war, remember. It might have worked then, but the argument is that now, in what is a vibrant democracy, with a pretty tenacious press and a National Assembly which is elected, and courts which seem to be independent, it doesn't work now. That's the argument. In other words, it's a model from a time that's gone.
Now, I understand that if President Park is forced to leave or goes willingly, a new election has to be mounted within 60 days. And you've just said, you know, all bets are off, but I'm going to still ask you to predict what might happen should that come about.
Yeah. I've got absolutely no idea what's going to happen. There you are. Journalist just said, I've got no idea what's going to happen. If there is this vote on Friday to impeach the president, I mean, an impeachment means, in effect, to have a trial. That will take many, many months. And at the end of it all, the highest court here, the kind of Supreme Court, will have a say in it and could, you know, block the whole thing right at the end. It needs a vote of judges. And the other thing is, Mr. Trump. We don't know how that's going to play out, and we don't know how relations between the United States and North Korea are going to play out. One of the arguments that President Park's supporters make is there are all kinds of uncertainties at the moment about the economy, but also about North Korea. You know, North Korea is marching towards having effective nuclear weapons, and that's not going to go away. It's only going to loom bigger and bigger, and the US is going to start getting much more concerned about that. It could be that Kim Jong-un becomes public enemy number one. So in that kind of situation where the tension is ramped up here in South Korea, then who knows what will happen with the presidency. I mean, it's anything's conceivable. It's even conceivable that people would say, well, we don't like President Park, or we don't like what, you know, 6 months down the road, we don't like her, but she's the one in charge. Maybe we need to not throw the captain off the ship when we're going into a storm.
You know, Steve Evans, I have to admit that I've been sitting here thinking what I wouldn't give to be a fly on the wall in Kim Jong-un's rooms at the moment. He must be having an utter field day.
Well, yeah. Who knows what's going on in his mind or in his kind of presidential compound? He's not a president, but it's the same kind of thing. He's not said anything about President-elect Trump. From the outside, they do seem to have one thing in common. They seem to be quite similar in some ways, and that is both of them have egos. These are not shy leaders. And both of them seem to be very easily slighted. We have Donald Trump's tweets where anybody who seems to cross him gets called sad and gets insulted, often at 3 o'clock in the morning. Kim Jong-un similarly has a tender ego, if you like. We had a situation 2 years ago where a barber in London put a picture of Kim Jong-un with his interesting hairstyle in the window and the slogan, don't have a bad hair day, come in and have a haircut, you know, using Kim Jong-un, made fun of Kim Jong-un. Well, his minions in London went round and tried to put pressure on the barber to take away the insulting picture. Well, actually, it wasn't an insulting picture, it was just an accurate picture of Kim Jong-un. So you get a sense of Kim Jong-un being a man who doesn't like being slighted. And in the White House, there will be a man who doesn't like being slighted. Let's imagine, these are not shy men, these two men, the man in Pyongyang and the man in Washington. They take slights. They react to slights. And let's imagine that Kim Jong-un starts insulting President Trump, as he will be, in a big way, in a very personal way. Now, and he will do. He does it with Obama. I can almost not say it, but he calls Obama a monkey, for example. It's deeply repellent, racist stuff. And there's no reaction from Washington. But let's imagine that somehow Donald Trump gets inside Kim Jong-un's head and Kim Jong-un gets inside Donald Trump's head. You know, we're in for exciting times on this peninsula, but maybe not in a good way.
Well, you have given us something else to lose sleep over. Steve Evans, BBC correspondent from Seoul, South Korea, thank you very much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Three views from around the world today on NPR News. That was Steve Evans in Seoul. After a check on the hour's news, we'll go to Russia to see how the results of the U.S. election are resonating there. But first, Phil Picardi in the NPR Newsroom. What are you watching this hour, Phil?
Good morning, Ewan. Today marks the 75th anniversary of the day President Franklin Roosevelt said would live in infamy. On this date in 1941, Imperial Japan attacked Pearl Harbor in Hawaii, drawing the U.S. into World War II. Today, survivors gather to honor the more than 2,300 service people killed in that attack. Donald Trump is Time Magazine's Person of the Year. The Manhattan real estate magnate went from fiery underdog to win the White House over Democrat Hillary Clinton. Times managing editor Nancy Gibbs says Clinton was the number two finalist. House Republicans are laying the groundwork for a new effort to overhaul the nation's food stamp program during Trump's presidency. The GOP majority of the House Agriculture Committee is releasing its two-year review today. It hints at strengthening current work requirements and encouraging healthier eating. Lawmakers are racing toward adjourning the battle-scarred Congress. They have unveiled stopgap spending legislation that would keep the government open through April. There's also a provision to speed up action on a waiver for retired General James Mattis to be Donald Trump's Secretary of Defense. Iraq's military says Islamic State militants launched an overnight attack against Iraqi security forces in the southeastern part of Mosul. The attack inflicted heavy losses, according to an army official who did not give specific casualty figures or further details. And British regulators have fined U.S. drug maker Pfizer and distributor Flynn Pharma a record $113 million for increasing the cost of an epilepsy drug by as much as 2,600%. The Competition and Markets Authority says the companies charged excessive and unfair prices to 48,000 customers in Britain. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:44.
On All Things Considered, we'll have the latest on the transition to the Trump administration and all the news you need from here in Minnesota. I'm Tom Cran. Join me weekdays for All Things Considered, starting at 3, here on Minnesota Public Radio News.
Support for this program comes from the Level 1 Pediatric Trauma Center at HCMC, offering a comprehensive array of life-saving resources. When your everything needs everything, turn to HCMC. More at hcmc.org/pediatric-trauma. Programming is supported by the University of Minnesota's School of Social Work, celebrating 100 years of preparing students to build a better world. More on the school and its 100th anniversary at socialwork.umn.edu.
You are listening to NPR News. I'm Ewan Kerr. Now we turn to Russia. Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin exchanged compliments during Trump's campaign, and many are wondering what sort of relationship the two will have after Trump is sworn in as president. Fred Weir is Moscow-based correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He's been living in Russia for 30 years. I asked him, what is the sense in Russia about the election of Donald Trump, and what does Russia really think about him?
Okay, it's complicated there. It depends which kind of Russians you talk to. There was a very high degree of interest, and obviously some of the things that Trump said fascinated Russians. And I don't mean the racist or Islamophobic things. It was just about foreign policy and especially relations with Russia, how he could get along with Putin, how we could work together. I think Russians, though they're in a patriotic phase, they're very worried about the isolation of Russia, the sanctions, the feeling of a new Cold War brewing, and they welcome, most Russians just welcome the idea that maybe Russia and the United States could get along. And I think that's the raw material of the very popular, response to Donald Trump in Russia. I mean, a poll was done after the election, of Russians, and 4% said they would have voted for Hillary, and almost half said they would have voted for Trump. That's like 11 or 12 times more. And then a lot of Russians, like a lot of Americans, said they wouldn't have voted at all. But they did follow it closely, and they did overwhelmingly favor Trump in their minds. But I talk a lot with foreign policy experts and policy makers, and they're much more ambivalent about it.
We were hearing that there was a feeling that perhaps Hillary Clinton would have taken a harder line on Russia, and then there were also skeptics who said that they also believed that Putin believes he could maybe better Trump if he was indeed elected as president. I mean, he would actually, because of his lack of experience as a world leader, then Vladimir Putin would be able to perhaps impose his will. I mean, is that still the sense?
I don't know the mind of Putin to that, whether he thinks he could outsmart Trump. But I do know a lot of people who are fairly high in policy making and policy advising circles, and their fear is that he's very unpredictable, impulsive guy. Trump. He says contradictory things, and what he does say, though it may be tantalizing, he never fleshes it out. So I think for those Russians whose job it will be to respond to Trump, are hopeful, but they think he's a black box, and they're going to wait and see.
Give us a sense of what life is like for ordinary Russians today. I mean, there's been so much change in the world with the Trump election, with Brexit, what's just happened in Italy. It seems from this viewpoint that there's a lot of uncertainty in the world. What's it like for ordinary Russians?
Yeah, they've gone through, you must remember, in the last quarter of a century, they've gone through total collapse, a long, decade-long economic depression, a certain amount of revival in the first decade of this century, in which living standards really improved. The country got sort of healthier in some ways. This is the basis of Putin's popularity, actually, that he sort of revived Russia. And in the past couple of years, there's been economic crisis, a deep, painful recession. But the Putin popularity and the sort of kind of general sense of patriotism that Russians have, it's something fairly new in my experience with Russians, but they are proud of their country, and they support their government, what it's doing in Ukraine and Syria and so on. It seems the overwhelming majority of Russians kind of support that. And that's a new thing, and it hasn't really changed. But the recession is biting in a lot of ways. Living standards have fallen. I mean, real incomes and so on have fallen in the past 2 years. Inflation, though it seems to be coming under control, was pretty bad last year. They say that Russia is pulling out of the recession, but average Russians haven't seen that yet. So it's an uncertain time. It really is.
Well, you said that there is Russian support for some of the things which the Russian government has been doing. So maybe if we could just briefly talk about Syria, because this week, earlier this week, Russia said it would start talks with the U.S. on a deal for the rebel holdouts in Syria so they could leave. But they've also said that any rebels who refuse to leave would be considered terrorists and, you know, subject to basically deadly assault. But there have been so many agreements, so many attempts at agreements over Syria since the conflict started in 2011, and many of them have just fallen through. I mean, is this likely to change given what's happening in the U.S. now? Is this agreement likely to have any more success?
Well, again, if you go by some of the things that Trump has thrown out there, he has said that he wants to get the United States out of the business of regime change, and he wants to work together with Russia to defeat ISIS and jihadi terrorism. The main bone of contention between the United States and Russia, the main reason that all those agreements have fallen through, is because the United States was simultaneously working, of course, against ISIS, but also still supporting the rebels, opposition, that wanted to overthrow Assad. Now, if Donald Trump removes that, then yes, I think this certainly is the hope of the Russian foreign policy community, but I also can't see why two countries couldn't work together then more coherently against ISIS.
I mean, is cooperation with Russia really possible for the United States? I mean, there just seems to be so much tension between the two sides, and the just constant jockeying for a position to try and get a better position. And Russia clearly, or Putin clearly, has, you know, enormous ambitions for his country.
Yeah, I personally, having grown up in the first Cold War and come over here and lived in the Soviet Union during that Cold War, and seen it end when the Soviet Union collapsed, and I have two children who are Russian citizens, I had real high hopes that that was all over with. And I've been stunned at how quickly a lot of that animosity, that bitterness, that poison, for even worse in some ways, has come bouncing back in the last couple of years. The war of words between Russia and the United States has really shocked me, the things that they say about each other and the attitudes. So I don't know. What you're pointing to is a real thing. It has a life of its own, and it's been bolstered by sanctions and dueling military exercises and so on. But I think that certainly in Syria, if the United States stops supporting efforts to overthrow Assad, if they bite that bullet, then I can't see why Russia and the United States couldn't forge some kind of tactical cooperation there. Other things are much harder. Ukraine, I don't see how the United States ever accepts the annexation of Crimea. There are much, much tougher dialogues that would have to take place, and we'd see. But really, Russia and the United States are not natural enemies, but they are always probably going to be geopolitical rivals. They're very different countries. They have different positions in the world, and they're always going to be bumping up against each other, I fear.
Our guest today is Fred Weir. He is the Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He joins us from just outside Moscow. You have been in Russia since 1986, I believe. That's a long, long time. And you've seen
30 years, yes.
You've seen a lot of change, obviously. What has surprised you over the past year or so as we go into this period of uncertainty?
Well, yes, and before I came to live here, I was a student of Russian history. That was my major at the University of Toronto, and so this is basically my life in a lot of ways. And I have been surprised at how resilient the old form of Russia is. You know, it was historically it was a certain kind of country, an autocracy, which was in many ways its own civilization. Then it became the Soviet Union and tried to completely change its definition of itself. Then it reverted to a new, supposedly modern sort of Russia when the Soviet Union collapsed. But it still is, and I suspect it was all along, exactly the same animal in a lot of ways, both in the political system, in the psychology of people, and in their, a lot of their, not just their language and culture, but in a lot of their attitudes as they look out on the world. Russia is a kind of eternal place, and this has finally really dawned on me.
You mentioned you've been surprised at some of the things coming back, as it were, the fierceness and the animosity. What are the most worrying trends that you see in Russia at the moment?
Well, okay, Russian domestic politics are becoming, and this is the old Russian poison, they're becoming over-centralized and hyper-dependent on one man. It's a very complex country. It is got a lot of institutions that work. A lot of the worst things that people say about it aren't really true, but it has this vulnerability that it doesn't have a modern democratic political system. It goes to great efforts to make it look like it does, but it really doesn't. And if, God forbid, that one guy should leave the scene tomorrow, no matter how well Russia is doing in a lot of ways, the whole thing will plunge into crisis. That's not a healthy thing. That is the single most worrisome thing in the Russian system. But it's also worrisome how it's gotten into these struggles with the West. I mean, I'm immersed in the Russian narrative, and I see their points. They're not entirely to blame for the way things turned out in Ukraine or Syria. They have their, but on the other hand, Putin has been pretty forward-leaning in handling these crises. Russians appreciate him for that, but I personally worry that Russia is working itself into a position where it will be at odds with much of the world, certainly the Western world, for the foreseeable future.
Fred Weir is the Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He has been in Russia since 1986. He joins us from just outside Moscow. Thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Fred Weir giving us the third in our hour-long Views from Around the World.